me, Patricia Pitsy Liang, the host of Fatal Attraction. I was just taking a nice, hot bath and listening to CJLO 1690 AM. Listening to CJLO is my favorite thing to do after a long, hard day of work.
For CJLO News, I'm Donald Roberge. Montreal police are investigating a series of vandalism incidents that occurred on Monday night. At least 16 metro stations in Montreal were targeted with pro-Palestinian posters and graffiti. Found on walls, doors, and bus shelters, mainly on the green and blue lines, the posters accused Canada of being complicit in the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. Some of the posters called for a ceasefire with a QR code directing the public to an upcoming demonstration. Montreal police first made the discovery early Tuesday morning after getting calls from commuters. Though the SPVM's Hate Crimes Division was initially put on the case, it was deemed that the graffiti did not incite violence towards a religious group. The crime has since been transferred to the SPVM's Metro Department for further investigation. Parking meters in some parts of Montreal will be extended to 11 p.m. as of November 15th. The need to pay for parking in most of downtown and Old Montreal will be extended an extra 2 hours. The Plan Administration says the decision will be more consistent with the operating hours of the area's businesses and cultural institutions. The city will also be extending the maximum time a vehicle can be parked in a spot from 3 hours to 5 hours to ensure drivers are not pressured to leave. The most significant difference will be on Saturdays, where paid parking will be extended an extra 5 hours from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m., though Sunday's hours from 1 to 6 p.m. will remain the same. Popular Montreal eatery, La Banquise, has been bought by the Quebec City-based restaurant chain, Ashton. A 24-hour snack bar that specializes in various types of poutine, La Banquise has been serving customers on Rachel Avenue East since 1968. In a press conference, Ashton announced that its purchase would not affect La Banquise's winning formula and that they were handpicked by their previous owners on condition that they would continue honoring their tradition. The popular Ashton chain currently has 23 restaurants in the Quebec City area.
Welcome back to CJLO 1690, and you're listening to this week's episode of Cadenza Montreal. I'm Stephanie Manning. Thanks for tuning in this week. We've got an exciting show with two interviews, one of them live and one of them pre-recorded. The first we'll have in just a few minutes is a live interview with Dr. Danielle Gaudry. She is the conductor and artistic director of the McGill University Wind Orchestra. They have a concert coming up this Friday night. And then later in the program, probably past 2:30 or so, we'll have an interview with Arya Umezawa, who is a Canadian stage director of opera, and she is directing the Opera de Montréal's production of Claudio Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppea, which will be performed this weekend in downtown Montreal. So to get us started before the interview with Dr. Gaudry, a little music. This is a piece that will be performed on the Wind Orchestra concert on Friday. It's by composer Viet Quang, who writes for all sorts of different types of ensembles, and wind ensemble being one of them. So this is a work that will be on Friday's program, Sound and Smoke. This is movement one called Feudal Castle Lights. And this recording is with conductor Andrew Trashill and the Ohio University Wind Symphony.
Thank you.
Welcome back to CJLO 1690 in Cadenza, Montreal. So we have our interview coming up with Dr. Danielle Gaudry. And so such that it doesn't get interrupted by an ad break, I'm going to take that a few minutes early. And then when we return, we will have the interview. So first, a quick word from an ad break.
Au cinéma public, nous proposons une programmation en salle composée de films d'ici et de nouveautés internationales, de classiques et des pépites méconnues, ainsi que de courts-métrages et des séances familiales. Nos billets sont parmi les moins chers à Montréal, 10$ au tarif régulier et 8$ pour les étudiants, les enfants et les aînés. Nous offrons également des cinécartes de 6 billets pour encore plus d'économies. Venez nous voir à la Casa d'Italia, juste en face de la station Jean Talon. Et rendez-vous au cinémapublic.ca pour découvrir notre programmation. Le cinéma public pour un cinéma vivant.
Welcome back to Cadenza Montreal. I'm joined live by Dr. Danielle Gaudry, the conductor and artistic director of the McGill Wind Orchestra. So the group has a concert this Friday in Pollack Hall. So Dr. Gaudry, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So this is your first year in this position, coming from teaching at California State University, East Bay, and you're returning to Canada, your home country, and also your alma mater of McGill. So how does it feel to be back in Montreal?
I have to say that it feels pretty amazing to be back here in Montreal. We were really looking forward to being back in this fantastic city that offers so much in terms of arts and culture and just has such a vibrancy and diversity that we were really looking forward to kind of being back in this major center, and also just happy to be home in Canada. We enjoyed our time in the United States, but it always feels great to come home, and so I'm very pleased to be back.
That's wonderful. And so, yeah, let's talk about Friday's concert a little bit. So there's 6 different pieces, and they're kind of all brought together under this concert title, which is Muses. So I'm wondering, how does that theme play into the works that are chosen here?
Well, the idea behind this program was that all of our pieces are inspired by something, some idea, some other art form, but that the common thread is that the music, the composers of this music were all inspired by something, and that kind of gave them the basis to create the work. So one of the pieces that we're doing is Contre qui rose, which is originally a work written for choir. And it was written it was a song cycle that was based on poetry. And then it was transcribed for band later. Another piece that we're doing, Sound and Smoke, is inspired by a line by Faust. And so each of the pieces kind of comes from a different place of inspiration. Illyrian Dances refers to Shakespeare and his reference to a place called Illyria. And then we're actually doing a world premiere in this concert where one of our student composers, Alexander Bridger, wrote a piece called All Along the Bronzed Tuckamore. And he was inspired by the beauty of the landscape in his native Newfoundland and wrote a piece representing that. So you can sort of see the thread going through the pieces where everything takes inspiration from something else.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I didn't realize that we had a world premiere on the program. That's super exciting. Is there how's the process been? Have you been like workshopping it with the composer?
We have. And it's been such a wonderful experience for our students to get to work with a composer, particularly when he's literally right here with us on campus. He comes to our rehearsals and gives us feedback as we are rehearsing it. And, you know, as a conductor, it's also, it's a huge advantage to be able to communicate on a daily basis throughout the rehearsal process. And especially with a new work like this, where we have the opportunity to say, did you mean this or did you mean that? Or what kind of sound are you looking for here? What is it that you were going after? And we have the opportunity to sort of help bring this piece to life. And so it's really been fantastic having Alex there in rehearsals. His teacher has come to rehearsals and kind of given input as well. So it's been a really interesting process, and the piece is really coming together. I think he's going to be really pleased with our performance on Friday.
Super interesting, yeah, and it's especially fun to sort of this collaborative aspect of music making. I read in your recent interview with McGill where you kind of talk about, you know, engaging your students in active music making. So do you think like you've kind of been able to put that into practice with like these rehearsals and working with this ensemble so far?
Absolutely. In fact, this week we've spent a lot of time discussing and asking ourselves how we're connecting with each other as we play through this music, because each piece is different. Each piece has a different compositional language and comes from a different perspective and a different place. And our job as musicians is to take all of that and interpret it and make sense of it for the audience. And sometimes it asks us to do different things. But this week, our conversations have really centered around how we're bringing this music to life, how we're working together to do that. How are we connecting with each other? How does this music, how does it, you know, come into being? And what do we need to do to make it interesting for the audience? So that's actually a really great question, because that's been one of our main focuses this week in our preparation.
That's awesome. And so, like, yeah, what are kind of the main themes that sort of come out of these conversations like this? Like, did the students have sort of ideas on how they can, is it about like performance or just like feeling like connected to the people around them?
I think it's always a collaborative process where students come to rehearsal with some ideas, right? They've spent some time practicing, and sometimes they have ideas. And, you know, in a large ensemble, it cannot always be a democratic process. Sometimes the conductor just needs to say, this is how it's going to be. But I always encourage students to think about how they're shaping a melody, how they're playing a certain passage, because ultimately it's about them expressing the music. And so, you know, we've talked about that, and students in our group are coming from all different places in their own musical journeys. Some students are, you know, first year undergraduate students, some are master students or doctoral students. We have people coming from really different backgrounds and perspectives. So not everybody is in the same place musically, but that is what makes this experience more interesting and even richer, because we all come with something to contribute to the overall result. But it's definitely something that I am often asking my students to think about, what they're doing and how they're doing it and how can they better support the people around them as they're performing.
Absolutely, yeah. And in my experience, I found like wind ensemble particularly is kind of very conducive to this, with, you know, you have like a lot of people in your section? Well, depending on how many instruments in your section as a double reed player, sometimes it's still not the case, but right. You know, generally more instrumentalists per section. I was kind of curious with, like, speaking of wind ensembles more generally, like in my university wind experience, I found that, you know, plenty of my fellow wind players kind of preferred to focus on like orchestral opportunities, but I grew up playing in wind bands. I've always had kind of a big appreciation for the music. I was curious about like what your favorite part is about this kind of ensemble.
You know, that's a really good question. I grew up playing in both concert bands, wind ensembles, and also orchestras, excuse me, and as well as jazz bands and rock bands. And I really played in a lot of different types of ensembles and was exposed to a lot of different types of music. But somehow I got bit by the band bug at some point in my university career, and it just became something of a passion for me. There's something about what we're able to do in a large instrumental ensemble that is mainly focused on winds and percussion, that there are sounds and colors and textures that we can't do with other ensembles. And there's just something about that speaks to me personally. And I just find that I connect with the repertoire and with the medium in general. And so not to say that I don't love going to concerts that involve other types of ensembles, because I do love that too. But there's something about wind music that speaks to me, you know, very fundamentally as a musician. And maybe it's because I'm a percussionist and, you know, I've spent time playing in different types of ensembles. And one thing that you do get in a wind group is that you there's a lot more work for you to do back there as a percussionist, as compared to maybe some other types of ensembles. So, yeah.
For sure, yeah, and percussion always has a lot to do back there. And yeah, I think that like something I also find exciting about wind ensembles, how new a lot of the music can be. I mean, as we've talked about, you know, there's a world premiere on this concert, and I believe all the music is like 20th century and beyond on this program. So I was also curious about like who are some composers that you think are writing exciting things for wind band right now.
There are so many new compositions coming out all the time that it's almost staggering sometimes to have to kind of sift through all of that, because I'll say that not all of it is great quality music. There certainly is a lot of it. But I like to find some composers that are writing pieces that not only I can connect with, but that I think that my students will also connect with, and that the audience members will also connect with. Because I think it takes all of us, right? We want to enjoy what we play, but we want to play to an audience. Nobody likes to play to an empty hall. But Viet Quang, who is the composer of one of our pieces on Friday called Sound and Smoke, he is a young composer who is writing really interesting music that is always so creative and innovative. And what I love about his music is that it's not repetitive or formulaic, in the sense that composers who write a lot of music, who put out a lot of music, sometimes can start to sound similar, where you hear something and you say, oh, that's definitely composer X, because it sounds exactly like their other piece. And so I find that Viet Quang does not do that. And that's one of the things I love about his writing, that each piece is really unique and its own piece. I also really enjoy the music of Kate Nishimura, who is a Canadian composer, and she has also been writing a lot of music lately. And I find her music just really accessible, and I love to use it, especially when I'm working with younger students, like when I go out to do honor bands and that sort of thing, where I'm working with high school students. Her music is really accessible, and it's very tuneful. She's really great at writing melodies, and that's a way that we can, you know, really connect with students. So those are just two examples of composers who are writing today that I can say that I love their music.
Fantastic. Yeah, the Via Quang piece, The Sound and Smoke, I played at the beginning of the program. And like you were saying, I had heard of him from his orchestral compositions. I hadn't actually realized he'd done wind band as well. And yeah, when I listened to it, I was like, it sounds very fitting for the ensemble. Like, it does not sound like, you know, someone who's written for orchestra playing for performing for wind ensemble. It's kind of its own thing. So yeah, I think that's quite strong, and it's a good like sense of that a composer can have to sort of move between mediums like that.
Yeah, I agree, definitely.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think we're about out of time, but I thank you so much for coming on today. I really enjoyed having you.
Thank you. It's been really wonderful to talk about our program on Friday, and I hope that some of your listeners might join us Friday night at 7:30 p.m. in Pollock Hall.
In Pollock Hall, right. Absolutely. Yes, and like best of luck on the concert, and thanks so much again for being on today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, well, that was a wonderful interview. We're just going to quickly move into some music for a minute and take a short break. And so we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back again to Cadenza Montreal. So in the interest of time, I think we're going to move from one interview into another. It was great speaking with Dr. Gaudry about her upcoming program. The piece that you just heard, that little fanfare right there, is called the Fanfare pour présider la Paris. It's the Paul Dukas. It's his ballet La Paris, and the fanfare that begins the work. It's this entr'acte with brass ensemble. So even though the work itself, I believe, is for orchestra, this is just brass only. So it makes it it's a perfect choice for a program like this with wind ensemble. And it's a fun little 2-minute fanfare right there. So transitioning a little bit to another interview, this is with Canadian stage director Ari Umezawa. So this was pre-recorded, so I will just let it play because I introduce who she is, what she's about. Afterwards, we'll take a quick ad break, and then we will hear some music from the opera that she and I talk about in this conversation. So keep your ear out for some of the music she might mention, because we're going to hear it later on in the show. Welcome back to Cadenza Montreal on CGLO 1690. I'm joined by Aria Umezawa, who is the stage director of L'Opera de Montréal's latest production, Claudio Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppea. Aria, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're originally from the Toronto area, but you're quite familiar with Montreal since you studied here at McGill. Is this your first time with Opera de Montréal?
It's my first time directing for them. I assisted for them on a production of Don Giovanni in 2015, and I've been back coach the Atelier Lyrique artists a couple of times as well. So it's a company that feels pretty familiar and welcoming to me.
That's awesome. So how has it been coming back this time in a stage director role with a company that like you've had some experience with and now kind of taking it to the next level?
Yeah. It's always really wonderful to come back to a company where you already have relationships with the people who work there. It's a really creative environment. It's a really supportive environment. And I have a lot of respect for the administration and the staff and the artists that are a part of that company. They're doing really excellent work. So it's been quite a treat to return to Montreal, and it's been a real pleasure working with the artists there.
Amazing. Yeah. And so, as you mentioned earlier with the Atelier Lyrique, the training program at the company. So I believe that if I have this right, the cast here is drawn entirely from that training program. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Everyone is either a current artist in the Young Program, or they've graduated from the Young Artist Program.
Okay, great. And so like what kind of stands out to you about this experience with like working with young professionals?
I think one thing that I've been reflecting on is these artists are, it sort of feels like you get a WB like Gossip Girl or like Dawson's Creek type cast. Everyone is really beautiful, like really talented. It's sort of a dream. In a lot of ways, they're very collaborative, very energetic. They bring really interesting ideas to the table. So it's been, yeah, like I say, it's just been a real pleasure working with all of them.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And in terms of the opera itself, it's quite interesting. This Baroque work from the mid 1600s and the original manuscript has been lost. So there's kind of decisions about what with the music and the libretto. So kind of how challenging is it to present a work like this?
It's a unique challenge, but I think the challenge is also an opportunity because we can really decide what is the story that we like to tell. What is the takeaway we'd like to communicate? And then we can use the material that is available really to tell that story. So cut down the opera. Otherwise, we'd be there for hours and hours and hours. So we cut down the opera to sort of just over 2 hours And we decided to really focus on the drama and motivations of the central characters. We cut out many of the scenes that involved like gods or goddesses or divine intervention. And we decided to focus really on the human story that's there, which I think we were able to do with a lot of flexibility, just because so much of the information we're trying to restore and recreate as we go. So it's certainly a challenge. There are a lot of things to sort of, there are a lot of tangles to untangle and a lot of things to iron out. But in that, we also get to really tailor the show to what we would like it to be.
Fantastic. Yeah. And so the, like, for those who are more unfamiliar with the opera, sort of, you talk about the drama with the central characters here. So what is kind of that, that character drama that the opera is focusing in on?
Yeah, so the story tells, it depicts Poppaea's rise to power. Poppaea was the second wife of Emperor Nero from Rome. And I mean, one of the goddess scenes that we did preserve was there's fortune, virtue, and love meet at the opera to decide who is more influential over the hearts and minds of humans. And they determine that it's love. And then the story is about how Poppaea wields love and passion to manipulate Nero into exiling his current wife, the Empress Ottavia, and replacing Ottavia with Poppaea on the throne. So there's a lot of like double crossing, backstabbing, whispering in people's ears, for example, in the story.
Great. Yeah. And so I'm curious, like, what your sort of main vision or inspiration with this production is in terms of how it's being staged.
Yeah, I was really drawing a lot of inspiration from the writings of the award-winning author Robert A. Caro, who wrote books like The Power Broker. He wrote, was really well known for his biographies on Lyndon B. Johnson and Robert Moses, who was a prominent figure in, he shaped essentially all of Manhattan and New York, and wielded incredible political power despite never having been elected to office. And Robert Caro says that unlike what we've learned from Lord Acton's axiom that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, he says that power doesn't always corrupt, but power always reveals. So when a person acquires power, then you see what they always wanted to do with it. And so this idea of power revealing the true intentions of people once they acquire it sort of forms the basis of our show. So how is Poppaea different when she doesn't have power? Would she have to sort of conceal her true intentions? And then what do we learn about her and what she actually was after once she gets the power that she's been seeking? Is one of the questions that we asked ourselves as we were making this production.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in terms of like visually what the audience will see, are there kind of specific design choices that might be a little different or more just like something that might stand out visually to the audience?
I mean, like certainly we've taken a very modern approach. It's not like a period staging, for example, and it's very minimalist. We've created sort of a visual metaphor of the ascent to power with like a literal staircase that's modeled after like original Roman theaters from Athens. Roman theaters, they would have like staircases in them that would kind of lead up to a temple for Venus specifically. And so that's sort of what the set is based off of, but we've taken a very modern approach to it. So that becomes our metaphor for like the ascent of power. And then in terms of this idea of concealing and revealing, we have costumes, pieces, and a chorus that comes in masks and cloaks, and they sort of pull back their cloaks and reveal who their characters are underneath throughout the opera. So we've really kind of leaned into this idea of both this ascent to power and the people on stage concealing and revealing themselves throughout the show.
Fascinating. Yeah. So in terms of the staircase, is this kind of a physical prop that people actually sort of ascend literally during the show?
Yes.
Okay. Very interesting. So yeah. And you talk about how it's, you know, it's pretty modern, pretty minimalist. I was curious too about with musically, if it's period instruments or modern instruments.
Yeah. So we have a continuous section that is period instruments. And then there will be, for some of the larger orchestral sections, it's Orchestre Angora, led by our music director, Nicolas Ellis. And so there's a mix of modern instruments for the overall orchestra, but then some period instruments to form the continuo section. And we're tuned to 4:15. So we'll be not at A440, for example.
Gotcha. Right. And so from what I could find, the Opera de Montréal first staged this production back in 2000, and it was their first venture into Baroque opera. I was curious if you had kind of gone back to that production at all, and if there was sort of any inspiration from that, or if this is kind of just a new, you're saying, more modern take on it.
Yeah, I try not to really let myself be influenced too much by past productions. Certainly you want to have an awareness of what's come before. But I don't really feel obligated to explore the same ideas that were explored in previous iterations of the production, or even really to, I think my obligation is to the text and to the music and to the people who are creating today, not the people who were creating 10, 20, 100, 200, 400 years ago. So this is very much our own production, and very much an honest reaction from the people that are on this particular production for the things that were jumping out at us about the material we were presented with.
Absolutely. So is there kind of a favorite sort of change you made, or a favorite aspect of the production that you've emphasized, based on conversations with this specific team and performers?
Yeah, I mean, I think audiences can expect that our Pur Timiro, which is the finale of the piece, probably arguably, so if you were to know any piece of music from the opera, you might know this duet at the end of it. And it's typically treated as a very romantic, love triumphing overall piece. And we've decided to subvert it, essentially, and show how when Poppea and Nero got together, when they were finally united, it wasn't an auspicious union. It actually signified a period of decline for the Roman Empire and a lot of suffering for the people of Rome. So we've decided to work towards showcasing that in that duet, which kind of makes it feel a bit uncomfortable and ironic. And I think that that's a really strong choice that we've made for this production. I think the choices that we made that were deliberately discontinuous from perhaps choices that have been made before us, I think are getting a little bit too into the weeds, a little bit too specific to a piece of text or a figure that we've been looking at that we sort of thought, well, probably most people would think this, but I think we have a good case to make a different choice. And wouldn't want to bog people down with too many of the tiny, tiny details that we've injected them there. And hopefully it's just communicated through people appreciating the amount of thought that went into this production.
Yeah, for sure. Well, unfortunately, that's about all the time that we had for today. But Aria, thanks so much again for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Stephanie.
Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
Welcome back to Cadenza Montreal on CGLO 1690. Hopefully you enjoyed that interview with opera director Arya Umezawa. That was a fun, it was fun to talk to her and to learn about the production. So just as a reminder, that production is going on this weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, I believe. It's the Opera de Montreal that is putting that on. So, and she talked about right at the end, this duet that also appears at the end of the opera, Porti Miro. And so I thought that it would be quite a nice tie-in to actually hear that piece and listen to it now that we've sort of heard her take on it, her background about, she spoke about how it's kind of an ironic twist on this this piece being very celebratory and celebrating their love, and yet in the background it's actually the symbol of decline that is yet to come. So this is, again, this is Claudio Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppea. So this recording here is the English Baroque soloists under the direction of John Elliott Gardiner.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Cadenza Montreal. So yes, what you heard just now was the Coronation of Poppea by Claudio Monteverdi. That's the duet that appears right at the end between the two central characters, Nero and Poppea. And for listeners who might not be as familiar with some of the contexts of earlier historical operas like these, you might have been confused at the, you know, why is it two female voices singing, right? You've got the, this is the main couple of the story, Poppea and Nero, the Roman emperor. And that's because Monteverdi initially wrote this piece for two female sopranos and three male sopranos, or castratos. And that has, you know, a whole backstory, which I won't get into right now. But in all that to say that in modern times, this these are performed with sopranos singing the roles, so women singing the roles of men, which I think is a very interesting to see, you know, today in this context. And since this opera is from the 1600s, and it was written with male sopranos in mind, so that kind of explains right there. But it's a beautiful little aria. And for those who do know opera, as Aria mentioned in the interview earlier, that may be the piece that you do know from this opera, which again will be performed this weekend at the Opera de Montréal. So I think we have time just for one more piece. The Viet Quang piece from earlier that I was talking with Dr. Danielle Gaudry, I'd really love to go back to that and to play the second movement. So I think that'll take us to the end of the show. So thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode, and I hope to see you in the next one. So this is the second movement of Viet Quang Sound and Smoke, called Avalanche of Eyes. Thank you.
Thank you.